the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Friday, September 25th, 2015. On today's show, we'll feature a one-hour special on women and mass incarceration. We'll hear from an academic, a judge, and a former cop. Dr. Carl Hart will explain how the war on drugs aimed at women and mothers is based on bad science. Judge Pamela Alexander will shed light on racist drug sentencing disparities. And Jack Cole, founding member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, will explain the role of police in the war on drugs. All three of them are speakers at a summit this week at UC Irvine on women and mass incarceration. Today's program, which is coming up after the break, is a taped show as a result of KPFK staff cuts. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Women's bodies are highly policed in today's society. Pregnant women's bodies are even more policed. Longtime African-American model Beverly Johnson revealed this week in her biography how she once took drugs while she was pregnant. She also lost custody of her daughter. We might jump to judge her because we're told by doctors, politicians, social workers, and others that everything you consume while pregnant can damage your child. In fact, prosecutors all over the country have targeted pregnant women who have taken drugs in the interest of protecting their fetuses. But what if the science of how drugs impact our bodies was not as solid as we might think? My guest is a pioneer in challenging what we know about drug use. Dr. Carl Hart is an associate professor of psychology at the Department of Psychology and Psychiatry at the University of Columbia. His book is called High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. Welcome to Uprising, Dr. Hart.
Thank you for having me, and I'm so excited to be on Progressive Radio, finally.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, this is such an important topic, and we're seeing today the criminalization of women and pregnant mothers at a very dangerous and alarming level. So how do you explain to the layperson, particularly, you know, a pregnant woman who might be listening now and who's hearing and kind of flabbergasted that the notion that if she takes drugs, it might not be as, you know, life, you know, horrible and impacting her baby's health for life as doctors have told her?
Well, I don't know which doctors are telling people that, but that's clearly medical malpractice because on the one hand, as a doctor, you don't want to, you know, you certainly don't want to put your patients at risk. But by that same token, that doesn't give you a license to lie about the extent or the potential harms of using a drug or not exercising or eating too much sugar. All of these kinds of things we know are not necessarily the best for a developing fetus, but it doesn't mean that they will all ruin the fetus. And this is the case with drugs, whether we're talking about a drug like cocaine, caffeine, nicotine, methadone, heroin. All of these sorts of things we want to discourage people from doing when they're pregnant. But if they do it while they're pregnant, because oftentimes many women don't know they're pregnant in the first few months or so, and so certainly people use drugs unwittingly, if they actually do this, it doesn't mean that the child is doomed for life. In fact, that's a rare incident, and it requires the heaviest drug-using women while pregnant in order to see any of these sort of harmful effects that people have been warning against. But we've known this in medicine. This is not new.
And so how do you respond when you hear of prosecutors going after women who are pregnant and found to have been taking drugs, particularly poor women who in some states now are required to do drug testing of their urine before they can be eligible for state benefits?
Yeah, I'm glad you said poor women, because this certainly does not happen to women of means. And how I respond is that it would be helpful if we were able to highlight, shine a light on this, publicize those prosecutors who are actually doing this and who are engaging in dishonest behavior, particularly if they are claiming these dire consequences. That's just simply not true. And so I would hope that we would publicize this so we can expose this inappropriate behavior.
And so then how do you explain the science? Because, we are told that the placenta is extremely permeable. Everything you eat and drink, if you're around secondhand smoke, is, essentially equivalent to your developing fetus engaging in those same behaviors. It impacts your brain, neurology, et cetera. I'm just paraphrasing what I've heard from the media, from doctors, et cetera. So how do you explain to the lay audience what happens when, say, a pregnant woman might smoke marijuana or a cigarette or or take other drugs, meth, for example?
Well, if a pregnant woman goes in the subway at in New York City, particularly at 168th Street, there are quite a few toxins that we all have to breathe there every day when we go to work. It's probably about the same as someone smoking tobacco, cigarette. These kinds of things, we want to minimize exposure to these things, but in some cases you can't. You just simply can't avoid exposure to these things. It doesn't mean that the fetus will somehow be harmful, certainly in perceptible or ways that we can actually see. We don't live in a perfect world. And so the notion that we can have a fetus develop in a perfect environment, it's just a pipe dream. I mean, obviously, we want to discourage unnecessary drug use. We want to discourage lack of exercising. We want to discourage too much sugar, poor dietary habits. We want to discourage all of these things while people are pregnant or in life in general. But it doesn't mean that we should have so severe consequences when these things, when our expectations are met. The consequences outweigh. They are too harsh. They overestimated the harms associated with it.
Now, obviously, you are in a field that studies these issues, and your colleagues aren't speaking out as vociferously as you about these issues. How much responsibility do scientists bear in sort of not explaining clearly enough the dangers, or rather the lack of dangers of drugs?
Well, you say my colleagues are not speaking out. Well, we live in a country where we have racial discrimination, poverty, poor education, a wide range of problems which we all know, and most of us are not speaking out. Many of my colleagues are white, and they are from elite classes, and I am not. And I come from the hood, basically, shorthand. And I have to go back to the hood, and I am responsible to a large number of people. And I would be less than an adult, a responsible adult, if I didn't do my best to make sure that I represent those people and poor people all around the country, because I am not a part of the elite class. And so I have this added pressure, I feel like, in order to speak the truth or speak it as I say. And understand that it's not only about me or my sort of status among my colleagues, but it's about the broader range of American people. And so, in terms of what my colleagues do, I can't really control that. I can only control what I can do.
And then these perceptions have real life consequences on particularly women, but people in general who are fed into the system of into our criminal justice system and become part of this mass incarceration complex, where such a large percentage of mostly black and brown folks are incarcerated for drug related charges. And we're starting to now unpack that. We're starting to question those, the disparity that we see, but doesn't the perception of the impacts, the harmful impacts of drugs, really feed the system?
Yeah, I think so. But I just want to be clear, because when you say we're starting to kind of understand these racial disparities, these are not racial disparity. This is racial discrimination.
Mm.
And I mean, that's how these things happen. We have made explicit choices where we were going to put our law enforcement and so forth. We call that racial discrimination. And so when we think about what role drugs play and the perceptions of drugs play, drugs are just, or drug policy and drug enforcement just becomes another tool in this vast toolbox that the American people have had in order to further marginalize people in the society. And so drugs are not special. Drug policy isn't special in that regard. It's a tool. And we have a number of these tools. And one of the things that I'm trying to do is trying to take away that tool as a means to further marginalize people.
Do we over-criminalize drugs?
Of course we over-criminalize drugs. I mean, we over-criminalize drugs. I mean, when we think about this, let's just think about this fact. The vast majority of people who use any drug, from heroin to marijuana to cocaine, 80-90% of them don't have a problem. And the vast majority of them take care of their family, they go to work, they are responsible people in society. Now, we think about the last three presidents of the United States, Bill Clinton, George Bush, Barack Obama. All of these guys reported illegal drug use. Barack Obama, marijuana and cocaine. George Bush, marijuana, widely suspected of cocaine, although he hasn't been an adult enough to admit it publicly. Bill Clinton, marijuana, of course. Now, you have all of these people in the country who use illegal drugs and throughout the country. Now, we don't over-penalize them because we like them, or there are certain types of people in our society we like. We only are harsh in our penalties with people who we don't like primarily. And those are the marginalized people in society. And so these drug policies and enforcement, just as I pointed out, continue to be used as a tool to make sure people know their place.
Right. Now we are seeing a move to decriminalize marijuana in particular in several states around the country. The marijuana legalization movement has slowly gained steam. Some have argued that those people who've benefited from marijuana legalization have been the very people who were less likely to land in jail over the last 30 or so years of the war on drugs. But what do you make of this move to legalize this drug?
I think it's interesting. It's an interesting experiment when we talk about legalization, not decriminalization. We're talking about legalization for recreational use for adults. I think it's an interesting experiment when you look at Alaska, Oregon, Colorado, and Washington. And I think we're watching to see how much revenue this generates, and see which we're trying to see a number of states are trying to see whether or not it's an approach that they should adopt. But it's one of these things that the time has come. This idea's time has come. I think that we should regulate all of these drugs and control the product. The major thing that I worry about as a scientist who studies these drugs, who have given thousands of doses of these drugs to people in the lab and carefully studied their response, my major concern is not with the drugs themselves. My major concern is with the adulterants, that is the cuts that the drug dealers use in order to stretch their product. I'm more concerned about those adulterants. And one of the things that the legal regulated market would do is that it would get rid of that sort of concern. That's where the real dangers with drugs lie, not the actual use of drugs. We know they can potentially be dangerous. Like if you use marijuana, caffeine, or heroin or something, obviously they carry some potential harms. Just like driving your automobile carries some potential harm. Just like engaging in sexual behavior carries some potential harm. One way we deal with driving your automobile or sexual behavior is that we use education. We put in some safety nets to make sure that people, that we enhance the safety of these sorts of things. The same thing can be done with all of these drugs we're talking about. Trust me, I know, as I pointed out, we give these drugs on a daily basis, and we do so under the auspices of your tax dollars. The American public supports this every day, giving thousands of doses of these drugs to people. And we do this so we can provide information, so our country is less ignorant about drugs. The problem is, people just haven't read the past 30 years of research and work that we have produced showing that these drugs are not as dangerous as we have been told.
One of the ways in which drug use is used to criminalize people, particularly as we've seen over the last year when police brutality issues have come to the fore, is to, you know, demonize drug users. Mike Brown's toxicology report, or Trayvon Martin's toxicology report, Sandra Bland's toxicology reports showing that there might have been drugs in their system, and this is often not necessarily used in a court of law, although sometimes it is, but often even in the court of public opinion, when the issue of someone's drug use leads in the headline, almost as if to justify what police might have done to them. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I think that, you know, that's one of the things that angers me more than anything. And I think oftentimes the people who are doing this are the district attorneys in those various regions. We think about Trayvon Martin, we think about Mike Brown, we think about Sandra Bland. The district attorney comes out and says that, oh, they had large amounts of marijuana in their system in these cases. And in every case, they were absolutely wrong. In each case, those people had the amount of marijuana that would be equivalent to like placebo. Wow. And I think those district attorneys should be fired, or they should be jailed, because that's the kind of irresponsible behavior that is allowed to go on in our country, and it perpetuates racial discrimination. And people don't call out those races. That's what they are, in my view. And so one of the things I think we should do also is that we should make it mandatory for folks, when these district attorneys say these sorts of things, they should be required to release the toxicology at that moment. They never do. What they do is they wait several weeks later and then they release it. And then people like me, like I've written on Sandra Bland, I've written on Trayvon Martin, and when I got the actual toxicology, and then you see that these folks were just lying. They were misleading the public. There was a case right now that recently happened, Sarah Circle Bear, a Native American woman, died in jail, I think in South Dakota, July the 5th, and they said that she died because of a methamphetamine overdose. It is really difficult to die from a methamphetamine overdose. I find that hard to believe, but I've been trying to get the toxicology, and I can't, because they say they won't release it. But this district attorney said that she died because of methamphetamine toxicity, which is hard to believe. But this irresponsible behavior is allowed to continue to be paraded in our country, and these guys get to walk around as if they are representative of the American people. And that's the thing that I find abhorrent.
And so all of these issues go back to this mistaken notion that is not really based on the scientific evidence that you and others have pointed out year after year. It's based on this notion that drug use can impact your behavior greatly, turn you into a criminal, can be passed down to your baby if you're pregnant, etc. How can the public educate themselves about the real impacts of drug and the real role, the sort of realistic and science-based role that drugs play in our bodies?
Well, one of the things that I did, I wrote my book recently, High Price, yeah. And that was aimed at the public to be a relatively accessible book with some of these science, many of these science facts. And so I wrote the book to communicate with the general public. I have a website, drcarhart.com. I try and put out information that's accessible to people. I'm trying my best. There are a number of other people out here doing the same sort of thing. So if the public, I really hope the public reaches out and read some of this stuff.
I want to thank you so much, Dr. Hart, for all the work you do and for spending this time with us today.
Thank you for having me on Uprising Radio. It's a beautiful title, and you know, it reminds me of the Bob Marley album, as you know, I'm sure, Uprising. And so,
yeah,
Power to you, sister. Keep doing your thing.
Thank you so much. Dr. Carl Hart is an associate professor of psychology at the Department of Psychology and Psychiatry at the University of Columbia. His book is called High Price: A Neuroscientist's Journey to Self-Discovery That Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Women are increasingly criminalized in our system of mass incarceration. And in fact, while the vast majority of U.S. prison inmates are men, the rate of women's incarceration is increasing twice as fast as men's incarceration. A large percentage of the women who are incarcerated, particularly Black and Brown women, are charged and convicted of drug-related incidents and serving lengthy prison terms. For years, it was known that drug sentencing disparities based on race have existed and served to impact communities of color disproportionately. Whites were sentenced to far shorter terms than Blacks. It wasn't until former Attorney General Eric Holder took action on those disparities that the nation finally began to deal with one aspect of racism in our justice system. But my guest began raising the issue many years ago. Judge Pamela Alexander is the district court judge at the 4th Judicial District in Minnesota. Decades ago, she attempted to point out that the different sentencing guidelines for powder cocaine and crack cocaine resulted in African Americans serving longer sentences than whites. I'm so pleased to welcome to the program Judge Alexander.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, we just heard from Dr. Carl Hart about how so much of the our impressions of the impact of drugs on our body is based on bad science. But let's talk about how the policies itself are impacted, play out so differently. Tell us what you came up with in your career, which you paid a personal price for, decades ago when you started seeing these sentencing disparities.
It is not new in our country. Actually, since its inception, there's been differing criminal justice policy and sentencing as it relates to communities of color. It's been historic. It's happened for years. Even with the 13th Amendment, there was an exception that a person could be put in servitude if they were they were convicted of a crime. So even though the 13th Amendment allegedly freed African Americans in this country, it did not free those who were incarcerated. So I think that people need to understand that some of the legal definitions in criminal justice policy overall has had its stake historically over the years in having differentiated sentencings between whites and communities of color. So this is something that's not new. In terms of, and I'm glad that Dr. Hart went before me because, first of all, he's absolutely fascinating.
And yes. Then,
as part of the arguments that were made before me, when I held that the penalties between crack and powder cocaine had to be equalized, part of it was to say that crack was so much worse. And arguments were made in my court, too, that to convince me that that was true when it actually turned out to be the exact same drug, only in a different form. And so there was really no real reason to have differentiated sentences for persons who possess crack cocaine as opposed to those who possess powder cocaine. Now, in Minnesota, our disparities were not quite as bad as the federal disparities. We were actually like 10 to 1. At that time, and this was in the early 90s, it was 100 to 1. It's gotten a little bit better under Attorney General Holder. Now it's 18. But it's still not equalized, which I think is a travesty because it is clearly racially unjust.
And so how did those policies come about to begin with? Because when you look at it on the face of it, it sounds like a conspiracy. Let's give let's associate longer sentences with the drugs that African Americans are more likely to use. But did it turn out that way?
Well, I think the policy started because of political hysteria, to be real honest. There was a young basketball player by the name of Len Bias who died of a powder cocaine overdose. His senator at the time who was a huge basketball fan, decided that there needed to be increased penalties for those who ingested and possessed cocaine. There started to be a political hysteria around it, and these laws were pushed through Congress very quickly without the proper vetting. It was done out of people saying, oh, it's crack cocaine, it's crack babies, it's crack addicted moms, it's all of this, and we have to stop this drug. And there was, of course, a picture in American society that this was all black people run amok, which is not, real unusual in terms of criminal justice policy overall, because we've always had differentiated sentences when it looks like communities of color where the drug is within that community. One of the best examples, and I always use marijuana because it's great, when marijuana was thought to be used by in the black community by jazz musicians, those types of people, then you went to prison. It was a felony. Then when it permeated into other parts of the country, then it became, oh, well, let's look at it a little bit differently. It started being used on college campuses, then it became a misdemeanor. Then when it started to be everybody using it, then it became a petty misdemeanor. So now it's right. Like getting a traffic ticket. But there were still people in prison for having the same amount of marijuana that were felons, that were black, that are still serving those very long prison sentences. So that kind of criminal justice policy has always been based on politics. It hasn't really been based on any science whatsoever.
And so tell us about what happened when you began noticing these different sentences and began raising this in your career.
Well, obviously this case just came before me. I looked at it. This came before me in 1990. I said, the lawyers argued very eloquently, in my view, that 90% of the people who were going to prison for possession of very, very, very small amounts of crack cocaine, and I mean so small they were almost getting eaten up in testing.
Oh, my goodness.
And they were getting, 5-10 year sentences, whereas the same person with the same amount, another person with the same amount of powder cocaine was given probation. And then statistically, it just bore out. They showed me very clearly that of the 87 defendants that we looked at, that 90% of the crack cocaine users were supposed to get a prison sentence, and about 82% of the powder cocaine defendants were supposed to get a probationary sentence. And it was very clear who was using what. And so and where the arrests were really taking place. So most of the crack cocaine arrests were being done in very poor sections of the city, whereas most of the powder cocaine arrests were being done in the suburbs and other affluent areas. And so it became very clear that there was going to be a racial impact here. So the lawyers argued an equal protection argument, which I found compelling, and then wrote that in my opinion when I held that the law was unconstitutional and that the penalties had to be equal. I then, of course, was vilified.
Right. You were labeled an activist judge, right?
Yeah. Well, I was labeled that, which was actually pretty interesting, although it's something I've grown to embrace. It was very interesting at the time because what I did in the case was certified it as an important and doubtful question to our Supreme Court to give the trial judges an opportunity to get some insight from our Supreme Court as to how they wanted to go on this issue. And so I certified it jumping past our Court of Appeals at that time in asking them to accept this question, which they did. This is not an activist approach, by the way. This is a very measured approach, and so our Supreme Court decided to take up the question. They did take a little over a year to affirm my decision in a 6-1 opinion and an order that was written by the late Justice Rosalie Wall, which is absolutely phenomenal, and she got the issue right away. So it wasn't one of those things where, you know, I was just off on the deep end. I really did try to look at the case and say, we have a number of people this is affecting. And so we need to really know, as the 200 plus trial judges in the state, how we should go forward on this issue. And our Supreme Court did give us that guidance. Hmm.
And you personally were, you know, you paid a personal price for taking these positions. You had been nominated to be a U.S. District Court judge in 1994. And would it be fair to say that your position on this drug sentencing issue led you to lose that?
It certainly had an impact, yes. Hmm. That and another case that they didn't like that I did as well. Hmm. So,
and then you were vindicated just in the last few months and in the last year or so. How did you react when the issue of racial discrimination, as Dr. Carl Hart insisted we say, in sentencing was tackled at the national level, at the federal level? And what is to become of all those people who continue to languish in prison?
The biggest problem that I have with it, and the problem I actually have with it today, is that this is a racially discriminatory law. The people who are in prison and still serving these sentences actually need to be let go. I know that there's a lot of people who may disagree with that, but when you look at the law was not fairly applied. If, in fact, they would have received the same sentences as the cocaine folks, the powder cocaine folks would have gotten, they would have been either probationary sentences or much less sentences, and they would be out in the street living their lives now. Some of those folks are still incarcerated, and it is abysmal that these cases haven't been brought down for resentencing at the rates that they should have. A lot of these folks should not be in jail on these sentences that were patently unfair. This has had an extreme impact on the African American community overall, because it's not only when you have someone who's incarcerated for many years, but that affects not only the person that's in jail, but also it affects all of the families and the communities that they come from. And I think it is it's horrible when you go through and you see the lack of young men within our communities and the lack of a number of young women who are also caught up in all of this whole drug hysteria it hasn't been looked at to correct, and it needs to be corrected, which makes me quite sad, actually, when I think about it, because this has been going on for 20 years. This has been a 20-year conversation. And how many people have we sent to prison in that time frame?
Now, you're speaking at a summit on Tuesday of this week focusing on women and mass incarceration. How are women impacted by, and how have women been impacted by the sentencing discrimination?
Well, I think it's been twofold. There's been several type of practices that I think have come about when we're looking at drug enforcement. Some of that has basically been not only going after dealers, users, and sellers. It's always been, in my view, low-level users that we're really getting at. So people who actually need treatment, people who actually are drug addicted and need some sort of help are not getting it because we're still giving them a prison response. We're also looking at this primarily in communities of color because those communities, young people are really getting ripped out of them, and it's had a very detrimental impact on communities overall. I'm concerned about women, I'm concerned about children, I'm concerned about African-American families, period, and the whole idea that mass incarceration has actually obliterated some communities, period. So I think it is, when we talk about mass incarceration, it's not just in a vacuum with those who may go to prison, it's what the after effects as well. Further, another area that I've looked at quite extensively is the collateral consequences of arrest and conviction and what happens to people after they serve their sentences and their families. And what we're seeing, it's also abysmal in those areas. In Minnesota, we have about 300 barriers to employment for people who have a felony conviction.
300?
Oh, yeah. Wow. So if you have a felony drug conviction in Minnesota, you can't be employed at our racetrack. They're shoveling manure because the legislature passed a law that says that if you have a drug conviction, you can't work anywhere in the gaming industry. So in any capacity, the same in hospitals. You can't work in any hospital setting or around any vulnerable person if you have a drug conviction. And that means in any area, it doesn't have to do, you may not touch a patient at all. You might work in the kitchen, apply for a job to work in the kitchen washing dishes, and you can't do that if it's health related. So that whole industry is off the plate for you. So now we are developing a permanent underclass of people who can't become employed, who can't take care of their families and can't go on with life, period.
And this has a ripple effect on their families and on their communities at large.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you, Judge Alexander, so much for joining us today and for being a leader in this field of drawing attention to these issues. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Judge Pamela Alexander is the district court judge with the 4th Judicial District in Minnesota. Decades ago, she attempted to point out that the different sentencing guidelines for powder cocaine and crack cocaine resulted in blacks serving longer sentences than whites. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The first point of interaction that ordinary Americans have that lead them into the prison system is with law enforcement. Police have been trained to behave as soldiers in a war in which drug dealers are enemy combatants and the public is collateral damage. The policing is often racially motivated, and departments have grown increasingly reliant on the extra funding to target drug sales. As a result, a huge proportion of inmates are imprisoned for drug-related offenses today. But one former officer has taken a very different view. Jack Cole is a retired state police lieutenant. He was with the New Jersey State Police for decades. He's also the founding member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And he now joins me from the summit at UC Irvine, where he and our other guests are speaking. Welcome to Uprising, Jack.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, first, how have police been trained traditionally to deal with drug use in communities that they come across? I mean, we certainly have such different types of police interaction depending upon what neighborhood they're in. But is there something in the training of police itself that has led to designed war on drugs resulting in so many people behind bars?
Absolutely. Since 1970, that was the beginning of the war on drugs, and that was when I went into undercover work. I was there for 14 years, so I saw this thing grow from nothing to what it is, this monster it's become today. And what we were trained to do was we were trained to go to war. Now, that is not the job for a police officer. That is a job for a soldier. As one of my colleagues likes to say, the difference between those two is, for instance, if you're a soldier and you're getting a sniper fire from a building, you call in an airstrike and you destroy the building. If you're a police officer and you're getting sniper fire from a building, your job is not to destroy that building and the person with the rifle. Your job is to protect and get everybody out of that building safe, including the person that's trying to kill you. That's a very, very different job. But when we train our police officers to go to war, that's a terrible metaphor in a democratic society, because when you're trained to go to war, you have to have an enemy, and the enemy becomes basically everybody but us. So because we're trained to do this, it changes our attitudes a great deal. Now, when you're in a war situation, the means are justified by the ends, by the fact that you're going to win that war. And when you start teaching your police officers that, that's when you get certain officers that figure, well, my job is to get the drug dealers off the street, and any way I can do that, that's okay. So we know who's dealing drugs on the street. And if we go to rouse them one day and they don't happen to have drugs on them, well, some of our folks just think, we'll just put a few drugs on them, and they're going to go to prison. We even have a name for that. It's called salting them. That's the reason we have so many police officers that lie on the stand, that perjure themselves, because they know that, if they tell the story exactly the way it went down, this person will probably be found not guilty because the case isn't quite that good enough. But if they just lie just a little bit, that person will go to prison. They've done their job. That is what teaching police to go to war is like.
And does that also come into play when law enforcement is attempting to deal with its own department budgets? A lot of money has been allocated to police departments over the years to combat the war, to deal with the war on drugs, to combat drugs on the street like a war. And so in being able to show that they're actively fighting this war, they continue to justify higher budgets. Money is involved.
That's right. It's estimated that in the war on drugs for the last 45 years, we spent $1.5 trillion or more on this war. Every year we continue it, it's another $80 billion down that same rat hole. And what do we have to show for it? Basically this, in the 45 years we've been fighting the war on drugs, in just this country alone, we have made more than 50 million arrests of nonviolent drug offenders. 50 million. I mean, there's countries that don't have 50 million people. Here we've made 50 million arrests. And what do we do then? We do everything we can possibly do to destroy those people's lives. We put as many of them in prison as we can. Even the ones that we don't, we take away their driver's license. We try to make sure that they'll never work again. We see that if they're young, they don't get any grants or loans to go to college. We don't allow mothers of children to even get food stamps or welfare. We do everything we can possibly do to destroy their lives. This is a strange way to go about it if what we really want to do is reduce drug abuse. But I haven't for many years thought that is our goal. Our goal is three things.
Yeah.
To make money, to gain power, and to continue racist ideas, to keep people in their place by using the powers of the drug war. That's why this thing started, and that's why it exists today.
And is that why so many officers who might, you know, otherwise be perfectly good people are invested in keeping the structure intact?
Well, there's a lot of reasons they're invested. One is this is the way they make their money. And, you know, drug violations, that is the only law in the United States for which when police officers make an arrest for a drug violation, they actually get paid for that. They don't get paid if they go out and make an arrest for murder or rape or robbery. Every year, the federal government sends grant money to every state, county, and municipal police department based on one thing. The amount of that fund, that grant, is based on one thing, and that is the number of arrests for drug violations they made the year before. So, which one do you think our administrators are going to target us on? Naturally, the drug violations.
Now, let's talk about how women are facing a lot of targeting from this war on drugs and in their interactions with police officers. The case of Sandra Bland became this huge national story in her interactions with police officers. And as we talked about in the program earlier, her toxicology report was released as a way to perhaps justify what was done to her, and perhaps in some way lead to speculation about her alleged suicide, etc. How are women impacted by the war on drugs, and particularly in their interactions with police?
Well, some women do use drugs. We don't think at LEAP, we don't think that anybody should be arrested for drug use or personal possession. As a matter of fact, we think we should legalize and regulate all these drugs, legalize them, take them out of the hands of the criminals, and end this terrible prohibition gun violence, regulate them and end overdose deaths, cut AIDS, spread and AIDS of hepatitis C by about 50%. There's wonderful things we could do by legalizing this stuff. But now, as for the women, when I was in narcotics, I think it's still the same today. We targeted women for one reason specifically, and that was to put a lot of pressure on the guys that were selling the drugs that were associated with them. When we'd go to arrest somebody for a drug violation, usually a guy, we would also do anything we could do to come up with an arrest with their wife or girlfriend or mother or sister, because that put a lot of pressure on this guy then to give us, to work for us and give up some of the drug dealers that they knew. But at some point in the course of this, when this all became such a numbers game, arrests was the name of it. It wasn't any longer to reduce drug abuse. It was all about making more and more and more arrests. And when that occurred, these women that were being arrested weren't let go when their husbands or boyfriends decided that they were going to give up names of people. What was happening was we'd arrest a guy and maybe arrest their wife too. Like in one case I'm thinking of, a woman, Amy Roston Polvall, was arrested because her and her husband were arrested for distributing ecstasy. He was arrested for distributing, she was arrested for conspiracy, because they had a 40-day wiretap on her home, and in 40 days, all the phone calls she got in 40 days, one phone call came in where somebody she didn't even know said, hi, this is Joe so-and-so, is your husband home? And she said, no, but he said if Joe calls, tell him I'm down at the corner of such and such. That one phone call got her 30 years in prison.
What?
30 years. And her husband, who was this huge international distributor of ecstasy, and she didn't even know it, by the way. She thought he was a hedge fund dealer. He got 4 years because he gave up a bunch of the people he was selling to, not the ones he was buying from.
Right.
He got 4 years in prison. She was sentenced to 30 years in prison because she didn't know anything about the drugs and she didn't have anybody to give up. And she was ethical enough that she probably wouldn't have given up even if she did know somebody. So 30 years, think about that. She was lucky enough, thank goodness, that when Bill Clinton went out at the end of his presidency, he pardoned her. So she served only 9 years for one phone call.
That's an incredible story. And I'm wondering, Jack, also on the issue of race, how we see people of color being targeted. Now, often, you know, one thing that goes through my mind, we hear stories constantly coming out of Hollywood of drug abuse and people dying of overdoses because they were hooked on whatever kinds of prescription medication or illegal narcotics. And it seems so rampant that one would imagine, why aren't police officers patrolling those neighborhoods? And studies even show that that African Americans are no more likely than whites to use drugs, yet police cluster in certain neighborhoods.
That's because we all want to get ahead. We want to get promoted. The way you can make promotions is you make more arrests. And the easiest arrests are the ones you want to make. And the easiest arrests to make are in the black communities because they happen to be the people that are dealing on the streets.
And also least able to fight back legally?
Pardon? It's what we call the low-hanging fruit. It's the easiest one to take, so that's what we take. Hmm. You know, I spent 14 years as an undercover agent. I could have done a lot of things. I could have infiltrated some judge's office and seen him snorting up coke with maybe a defense attorney in their chambers, because that does happen on occasion. But for me to get into a situation like that would have taken me months of undercover work, where instead I could go out and in a day grab three or four people who wanted to sell me a tiny little bit of any kind of drug. From anywhere from marijuana to heroin, and I get one digit for each arrest. That's all I get. You know, toward the end of my 14 years undercover, I was working billion-dollar international heroin and cocaine rings that didn't even exist, by the way, when we started this war, because we created this stuff out of whole cloth. But when I worked those jobs, I would work for 6 months, 8 months, a year on one job. And when we finished it, I got one digit for that job, just the same as the road trooper would get by stopping a car on the highway and making one arrest. So it's all about that low-hanging fruit. Some people would rather go out and just make these strange arrests. You know, you said I come from a New Jersey State Police. Well, one thing we're famous for, If we didn't create racial profiling, we certainly raised it to a high art form. And once we got it really perfected, my superintendent of state police called our best racial profilers in from the toll roads and the interstates, and they brought them down to division headquarters, and they created one unit out of all those people, a unit called the Interdiction Unit. Then, thanks to funding from DEA in something they called Operation Pipeline, we were sent around to 47 other states to teach them how to do what we were doing, racial profiling. And when I say racial profiling, it was really racial profiling. We, for instance, on our turnpike, our troopers used to drive up the turnpike and then stop on the shoulder, back up on the berm there so that they're perpendicular to the road, and the berm's raised a little so their headlights are out over the traffic, oncoming traffic, and they turn their spotlight on, and then sit there until they saw a car go by with black folks in it. Out they'd go, and they'd make an arrest. There was a study done by this by Joe Collum, who wrote a wonderful book called The Black Dragon. Joe Collum happened to be the person, a reporter, who coined the phrase racial profiling. And he did a study because one of the people that was stopped by one of our troopers, a black man driving a really hot car, BMW or Mercedes, which, of course, according to some of our police, the black folks aren't supposed to be driving. If they're driving that, they must be a drug dealer. So he was stopped, illegally searched, but he was a smart guy. Instead of making a complaint to the state police, where it would just be washed under the rug, he went to a TV station and he reported it to Joe Colum. Joe Colum thought, what are we going to do about this? He set up a TV camera on the northbound and the southbound lanes of the New Jersey Turnpike, just outside of Newark. And for an entire day, they counted all the cars that went by, and then they went over those videos and they counted every car that had at least one person of color in them. They averaged 22% of the cars on the turnpike had one person of color at least. Then they went down and they pulled the arrest statistics for that part of the turnpike, and they found that 88% of the people arrested on that turnpike were Black folks. 88%.
That's incredible. What about the move to legalize and regulate marijuana in various states? It seems to be a train that has left the station that is likely spreading around the country. California is looking very, likely to be able to pass some kind of legalization initiative in the next year or so. How will that change policing? And also, are law enforcement, are departments around the country fighting marijuana legalization?
Not all of them, but most of them are fighting it. And it will change law enforcement throughout this country and abroad. And in all of our states that have decriminalized a certain amount of marijuana or legalized marijuana, or the four states and the District of Columbia that have actually legalized use of marijuana, even for recreation purposes for adults, in every one of those instances, the situation is better than it was when we just had full prohibition. Every one of them. The stats are in for the first year from Colorado, and there's something like $60 million in taxes that they've brought in. They've created in the first month that they legalized, they created 15,000 new jobs. All kinds of people are moving into that state now that where they didn't have this tremendous amount of new people coming in. Crime is down both for violent and property crime in the last year. Use of marijuana by underage children is down.
That's incredible. So we have one piece of the solution in front of us. It remains to be seen how much that is adopted across the country. I want to thank you so much, Jack Cole, for joining us today.
You're very welcome. Always glad to be on with you.
Jack Cole is a retired state police lieutenant with the New Jersey State Police and the founding member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer and technical director. Teddy Robinson is our audio engineer. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. Have a wonderful weekend. I'll see you Monday.